How many of you have never been to Alaska before this trip? That's awesome. Well, welcome. So on behalf of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, I want to welcome you all to Anchorage, Alaska. I kind of can't believe we actually pulled this off. When we were first talking about doing a conference here in Alaska, Jeff and Beverly and I were really just hoping that we could get 800 people, because that means that we could break even. And we weren't sure that we'd actually be able to do that. And I am really happy to let you know that we've got over 1,300 people at this conference this year. So last year was our record breaker. We had 1,400, and we may actually come close by the end of the week to that record. So thank you all for showing up, and it's so exciting that you're here in Alaska. I'm sorry about the weather. It's been kind of crummy weather the last 2 days, but it's looking like we're going to get a break in the weather starting tomorrow. We're going to get some partly cloudy skies. So I really encourage folks to, if you have a chance, to at least even take out a couple hours out of your day, maybe today or tomorrow or Wednesday, and get out and do a little hiking. I think it's definitely something that you won't forget. We've got some nice trails here. We've got the Coastal Trail, which isn't far away. We've got Kincaid Park, which is down by the airport. And then we have the Hillside Trails, which there's a whole spiderweb network of trails there. And I know that a number of people have already actually gone up to Flat Top and hiked Flat Top, which is the most frequently climbed mountain in Alaska. So I really encourage you to go out and do that. But I also want to just let folks know that you should definitely be on the lookout for bears and moose. We do have brown bear, black bear, and moose here in the Anchorage Bowl, and they're kind of all over. Your chances of actually seeing a bear are probably pretty low, but your chances of seeing a moose are actually quite high, especially if you get out onto the single-track trails. So the best thing that I can recommend for you is, number one, when you go out, it's best to go out with a few people, at least two or three, and be loud, and that'll keep the bears away. And it won't necessarily keep the moose away, though. So if you do see a moose in the trail, the best thing to do is just stop and see what the moose is going to do. Make sure you have plenty of distance between you and the moose. Moose are very different than deer. Deer will run off. They're very skittish animals. Moose aren't so much. They'll just kind of look at you and kind of do their own thing. If it looks like the moose isn't going to move, just turn around and pick another trail. Tonight is the opening reception, and it's at a very special place. It's at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and we're really excited about this. It's mostly an outdoor venue, so please bring your raincoats and umbrellas. We're hoping that it's not going to be too rainy, but it might be. But I really encourage folks to come out, and it's such a neat opportunity to see some of the dwellings, the Alaska Native dwellings, and just learn a little bit more about Alaska Native culture. And then tomorrow morning is the walk/run, and that starts at 6:30 at the Hilton. So if you're going to go to that, I think it's a 3-mile walk/run, 6:30 at the Hilton. I also want to say, for tonight's opening reception, we'll have shuttle buses that'll go to and from the hotels. So it's really been an honor and a pleasure serving as the president this past year. I can't tell you how much I've learned, not only in my role as being the president, but on the executive board for the last 5 years. It's been such a joy, and the people that you get to meet being on the executive board and really get to know and truly become great friends. So it's really an honor, and I'd encourage all of you to get very involved in participating in CSTE. The best way to do that is just start working on a working group or a subcommittee. And if you're interested in becoming an executive board member, make that known. And we'll try and get you down that path, because it really is a great pleasure. As an organization, CSTE has several goals, including number one, being the professional home organization for applied epidemiologists. And then number two, developing position statements that recommend which diseases and conditions should be under national public health surveillance and what the responses to those conditions should be. And then number three, strengthening the applied public health workforce through fellowship programs and training opportunities. And then number four, advocating for the critical role of applied epidemiology practice in national discussions about public health and healthcare. So this conference is one opportunity to contribute to all of these goals. And many of our subcommittees and steering committees hold committee meetings during the conference where members can learn about all the good work that's being done. And I'd really encourage those of you who are not currently CSTE members to sign up today and become a member. So now I'd like to ask the subcommittee and steering committee chairs to please stand and be recognized. So if you could please do that, I'd really appreciate it. A lot of hard work these people put into CSTE. Thank you so much. Okay, so this year CSTE awarded its first annual student scholarship to Gabriel Hodges, funding her travel, lodging, and attendance to the conference. And Gabriel, I'm going to ask you to stand up in front of these 1,000-plus people. There she is, Gabriel. Or it's Gabriella. So Gabriella will graduate with a master's degree in public health from the University of Kentucky in August of 2016. She has maintained a 4.0 GPA and served in a leadership position for her school's student association and worked for the Kentucky Department of Public Health in the HAI prevention program. After graduation, she plans to continue working for the Laurel County Health Department, serving 8 counties in the southeastern Appalachian part of the state. So the student scholarship is really made possible by the charitable contributions of all of you through the CSTE website. And so I just want to say thank you to all of you for donating. And Gabriella, congratulations. Okay, so it really is a pleasure and an honor for me to introduce our first opening plenary speaker, Valerie Davidson. She is the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. And Commissioner Davidson, or Val, as she prefers to be called, was born and raised in Alaska and is of Yupik descent. She earned her undergraduate degree at the University of Alaska Southeast and her JD from the University of New Mexico School of Law. Prior to her appointment as commissioner in 2014, she worked for over 15 years as a national policymaker on matters affecting Alaska Native and American Indian health. She was the senior director of legal and intergovernmental affairs for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where she represented Alaska Native health needs at federal and state levels. In that role, she was the national chair to the Tribal Technical Advisory Group at CMS. She was also the spokesperson and chief political and legal strategist for the Dental Health Aid Therapy Program, which is the first mid-level dental health program in the United States. Val currently serves on the U.S. Department of Justice Advisory Committee on American Indian and Alaska Native Children Exposed to Violence, and she is a trustee of the First Alaskans Institute. And as her role is, in her role as commissioner, she's only been commissioner for just over a year, her most notable achievement so far has been the successful expansion of Medicaid in Alaska. So before I turn the microphone over to Val, I'd just like to inject a personal comment. It really is an honor to be able to work with her. She possesses a unique constellation of attributes that make her particularly effective as commissioner. She's got a strong intellect, a really good heart, and a ton of grit. And she also really gets public health, which is such a bonus for us. And another thing you'll soon find out is that Val is known throughout Alaska as a person who can skillfully communicate key messages through storytelling. And it's awesome. Val asked me, so what do you want me to talk about? I said, You know, tell them a story about your unique perspective of growing up here in Alaska, and especially in rural Alaska, being Alaska Native, working for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in a lot of big legal issues, and now as our commissioner. And it'd be great if you could do it without a PowerPoint. And she said, yes, that's exactly what I'll do. So without further ado, please help me welcome Commissioner Val Davidson.
Guyana Joe, I think that might have been the nicest introduction anyone has ever given for me, except for when my mother introduced me one time. She said, Banika, which is, this is my daughter. And then she said, she's a good girl. And I think I was 42 at the time. Good morning. Huinga nukhagalugwa amitlamakananthu yubiugwa mamdagitlagmiu anaka yubiuguk guinagmiuguk ataka gathauguk Port Orchard, Washington nagmiuguk. Good morning. My Yupik names are Nukhagaluk and amitlamakanan. My English name is Valerie Davidson. Feel free to call me by my Yupik name or my English name. Val is fine. In Yupik, we have this really great word. It's uzuk, which means, hey, you. And if you don't remember somebody's name, it's perfectly acceptable to say uzuk or us. But do be careful how you pronounce it, because there is a word that sounds very similar that is a really inappropriate name to call people. Feel free to ask a Yupik. I won't tell you what that is. I actually was born and raised in Bethel and also upriver in Aniak. My mother's family is from Guiginluk, and the village, if you're ever in Bethel, and I would encourage you to go, head downriver, and when you hit the ocean, hang a right. Her home village, the name literally means village with no river. Despite the fact that it is located on the ocean, it is more important to us that it has no river, because we use rivers for navigation. My father's family is Gasak, or Caucasian, or white, and they come from Port Orchard, Washington. And in the fine Yupik tradition, when a young man and young woman see each other from across the river, or maybe at the neighboring fish camp, and they smile at each other, and they fall in love, and they marry, and they start a family, these days not necessarily in that order, but that's okay. Love is love. We love kids. The young man completely uproots himself, and he moves to his wife's home village. And it is a tradition that continues to this day, and one, quite frankly, that we Yupik women are determined to perpetuate. But it's also why my brother lives in Qipnak to this day. So welcome to Alaska. I'm so glad you were all able to come. And if I may add, everything Joe said about moose and bears is correct. So definitely go outside, enjoy the outdoors. If you do encounter a moose, if you see that hair standing up on the back of the head, on the back of their back, definitely find another trail. And it's not yet hunting season, so not necessarily the time that you want to encounter a moose on the trail. So let me tell you a little bit about me. I'm a Head Start kid. Any other Head Start kids out there? Woohoo! So in my home community in Bethel and also in Aniak, my Head Start was in Aniak, and my Head Start teacher was chosen in that year. We were a Head Start pilot program. Our Head Start teacher had 12 children of her own, and I think the community thought, well, she's supremely qualified. Anybody who has 12 children who she's able to keep alive and happy and very responsible children, clearly she is the best choice. Her cousin was our community health aide and practitioner. Her name is Clara Morgan, and she retired after over 40 years of dedicated service to the community of Aniak and the surrounding villages. And Clara is whom we received all of our health care from. And everything from immunizations, Alaska Natives, Alaska tribes actually lead our immunization, on-time immunization rates in our state. And one of the reasons we do is because of people like Clara Morgan. They know when the babies are born, our communities are small. They know when we are trying to avoid the shots, and they know where our favorite hiding places are. And we also grew up in a time when you were walking during hours in which school was in session. You were stopped literally by every adult on the road. And I remember walking to on the road one time, and I got stopped by six adults asking me why I wasn't in school. And I said, I'm going to the clinic. And they said, why are you going to the clinic? I said, I'm going to go see Clara, because I really didn't want to answer the question. And finally, I was pressed, and I had to confess that I had an eraser stuck up my nose. And every single person said, again. Probably things that you shouldn't confess. But there is, you know, when we think about public health, there's also this incredible public informal surveillance effort that happens by every adult in the community, which is really, really a wonderful place to grow up. When I was small, we would see a dentist about once a year, and we would all be pulled out of school, and we would go and we would line up at the clinic. And when you only get to see a dentist once a year, if you're lucky, you have a lot of teeth that really need to be drilled, filled, and pulled. And we would stand there, and we would hear the screams of our siblings, our friends, and our cousins behind that door. I mean, literally screaming their heads off. And when they were done, the dentist would open the door, and he was wearing a butcher's apron, literally covered in blood. And our sibling, our friend, our cousin would stand, and they would be holding their mouth. And the question we always asked them was, how many? And we were asking how many teeth got pulled. And the most I remember was eight. And it was a really horrible experience, very traumatizing. And I remember... you know, every year in kindergarten, there was always somebody who wet their pants, because, of course, to stand there and wait your turn is really awful. And then we always had a runner, and some little kid would be standing there in line, and they'd take off out the door. And Clara was always very calm. She didn't chase after them. She gave them exactly 5 minutes to settle down, because she knew, and then she went out to go get them and bring them back. And the truth is, she didn't need to chase after us because she knew where all of our hiding places were. And so she came to bring us back, and when we came back, our reward was we got to be the next person in line. Because it's a lot easier to wait if you're the next person in line than if you're at the end of the line. And those experiences from that we had as children really were due to lack of good oral health care. Pre-contact, you know, we had no sugar, we had no a whole host of things. And once those things were introduced, no good prevention, not a lot of emphasis on brushing, etc., and that was all new to us. We didn't have to do that before because we didn't have all of those things. We were pretty much a meat and fish diet. Certainly some plants, but a lot of meat and a lot of fish. And to this day, I have a cousin who is, I think, going to be 40 here in a couple of months, who that experience was so traumatizing for her that to this day she cannot even have her teeth cleaned unless she is completely put under because it was such a traumatizing experience for her. And So that is a part of my childhood and a part of my story. And I tell it today. I know some of you are asking, why is she telling us this awful story? For a really simple reason. We bring experiences with us in the work that we do. And sometimes we're able to learn from those experiences and ask, is there another way to do things? And when I worked in tribal health, where I worked for 15 years, first at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel, which is where I'm from, and then, as Joe mentioned, at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And while we were there, we looked around and realized what a problem this was. And this didn't have to be. Yes, it was the way that it had been for a while. But it is not normal for people in their 50s to have dentures. It is not normal for people to be missing teeth. I know a young lady who graduated from high school with a full set of dentures. From high school. And I can't imagine anything more awful at that age when it's so much about appearance and et cetera. And knowing that everybody in your community and everybody in your class knows that you have dentures at 18. So the tribal health system, working with our partners at the Rasmussen Foundation, at the Kellogg Foundation, decided to do things differently. And we created, we sent people to New Zealand at first to learn how to become dental health aid therapists. And it's a mid-level dental practice that actually, oral health practice that exists in over 50 other countries. The United States is the only industrialized nation that does not have this as a part of their standard practice. And so we sent folks over, and we were promptly sued by the American Dental Association, the Alaska Dental Society. And they had millions in their budget. I think it was like $40 million litigation fund and a $10 million PR campaign fund. And I had $200,000 in an outside counsel budget. And I think we had maybe $1,000 in a PR budget at the time. But the good news is we were able to prevail. And in fact, we actually started a training program here in Alaska rather than sending people to New Zealand. And the first year of training here is in Anchorage, and the second year of training is in Bethel, because we felt really strongly that we wanted to be able to have a rural component so that people knew what it was they were going to be experiencing and where it was they were going to be working. And so I tell you that story for a couple of reasons. One is we knew that the statistics were bad. We knew that we experienced oral health disparities at our children experienced dental caries at 7.5 times the national average. We knew that our statistics were bad. But knowing those statistics is one thing. Doing something about it is quite different. And we spent a lot of time thinking about what's the best way. We did everything. We tried hiring more dentists, but you know, there's a dental shortage throughout the country, and it's hard enough to get dentists in Anchorage, much less in Bethel, or in a community where you may not even have running water. And so we decided to try something different. And we are thrilled that now we have cavity-free kids for the first time in our community since Contact, in a 10-year time period, cavity-free kids. My own children get their oral health care from the dental health aid therapist. My oldest daughter had a cavity finally when she was 11, and she cried for an hour. She was just devastated that she was no longer a cavity-free kid. And so I share that story just so that, you know, a couple of points. One is that sometimes we do things unintentionally in the name of public health that we think are for the right reasons, but they unintentionally may cause these other results, like my cousin who can't get her teeth cleaned because of that. I know that dentist personally who came to our village every year. He had the very best intentions. He was there for a short amount of time, and he was trying to get as much oral health care done as he possibly could. Was it the best way? Maybe not. But it's easy to say that looking here and looking back. I also learned several other things from that experience, is that while we were being sued, and of all health professionals, dental health aid therapists are the most studied, the most watched, the most, what do you call that? Thank you, Joe. Scrutinized health professional, really, in the world, and certainly in our country. I learned several things. One is that people do the most amazing things, and they will do the most amazing things under the most impossible of conditions, as long as they have the right reasons. As long as you have the right reasons, people will do the most amazing things under the most impossible conditions. And children are always the right reasons. The other thing I learned from that experience is that I used to think that you should do something even though it's hard. And what I learned from that experience is that sometimes you have to do something because it's hard. Because if you're not standing there in front all by yourself in that bright, shining light of judgment, someone else may not have the courage to stand there first. But if you stand there for the right reasons, other people may have the courage to be second, or third, or fourth. And some things are too important not to do. And the more outrageous it seems, the more maybe even ridiculous, when everybody else is saying, no, it can't be done, you shouldn't do it that way. Or maybe the times when we should really question whether we should be doing that, whether we should be standing out there in front. And a lesson I learned from my grandmother as a young child was, if you lead with love, you will never stand alone. If you lead with love, you will never stand alone. No matter what you are experiencing, as long as you lead with love and you lead with respect, you will never stand alone. So, excuse me. So somebody asked me the other day, well, what is it that Alaska Native and American Indian families want, you know, out of health and in their communities? And I said, our answer is, it's pretty simple. Alaska Native and American Indian families really want what every other American family wants. We want our children to be healthy. We want them to be happy. We want them to live in safe communities. We want them to be educated. We want them to have good economic opportunities. We all want the same thing for our children. But because of where we live and because of the federal government's unique trust relationship with tribes, we may have to do things differently in order to accomplish that same outcome. And so, you know, providing health care in a community, our average village size in Alaska is about 300 to 350 people. You know, that community isn't going to be able to sustain a doctor. But they can sustain a community health aide and a behavioral health aide and a dental health aide. And so those are the kinds of things that we do differently. There's a lot of innovation in Alaska simply because we are large. In the region that I'm from, which is where I flew in last night and I'll be flying back today. Our region is about the size of the state of Oregon, 75,000 square miles, and there are no roads connecting any communities, none. 58 federally recognized tribes, 58 communities, and no roads connecting. Again, all of our navigation is by river, and that's how we get from place to place. So I would really, when you're here, you will hear a lot of statistics about Alaska. You will hear a lot about our health challenges. And we say things like, we're much more likely to, Alaska Native people, we're much more likely to attempt suicide. We're much more likely to be, to experience rates of drowning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these statistics are interesting, and they are helpful, and they are necessary. But as we share those statistics with folks, I always ask, what's the point? So what? What are we doing with that information? Who has that information? Are people who appreciate the information the people who are living the experience, or are the people that are telling that experience? Both are important. And I know you certainly realize, you certainly recognize that, otherwise you wouldn't be doing this work. And I think sometimes when we speak about statistics, as I'm sharing with my mother, who still, I told her I was going to be speaking with you today, and she asked, where are they from? And I said, from all over. And she said, ah, United States of America. She still calls the lower 48 the United States of America. And she also loves statistics. Every time I travel outside to D.C., she tells me what the current crime statistics are in every community I'm visiting. So sometimes statistics are easier to remember than others. And when I leave, she always says, Nuchi, you be careful when you're down there in the United States of America. Like, okay, Mom, I will. So I guess the other thing I wanted to ask is, it's really interesting being in this role because my background really is in tribal health. And a lot of the innovations, quite frankly, that exist here in Alaska really exist in these incredible partnerships between tribes and the state and the federal government. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has an incredible epidemiology center that their report not only to the people, not only states these incredibly, really, if you want them, really awesome, very detailed, very thick statistics. But they also produce this, these documents that have it, that display it in other ways that are visually easier for people to understand. And when my daughter a couple of years ago was talking to one of my friends, my children are Yupik and they're also Zia Pueblo. Their dad is from New Mexico. So they are very aware of their Yupik, or mostly we live here in Alaska, and so they're mostly familiar with being Yupik. We spend our summers in Bethel. One of the deals I negotiated with my new boss is I would really like to be able to work out of Bethel. He said, I think we can arrange that. I said, I think we can keep talking. Because I want my children to know who they are. I want them to know where they come from. I want them to know who they really are as people, because that builds resilience. One of my children, though, a couple of years ago was talking with one of my friends, and my friend said, well, yes, because you're Alaska Native. And she said, no, I'm not. I'm Yupik. So she knew what kind of Alaska Native was, but she didn't know that she was Alaska Native, which I found shocking. And then I thought about it, and I talked to her a little bit. And she was, it was not my best mommy moment because, she should know. But she was absolutely vehement that she was not Alaska Native, because all of the messaging that she hears in our community and at school about Alaska Natives are negative. It's all the negative statistics. It's all of the stuff that is not good. She doesn't hear how innovative we are. She doesn't hear how scientific we are. She doesn't hear about all of those things. She instead hears the negative. And it made me think about, what are the messages that we are sending to our children? And what is it we are doing to our children that they already know in third grade that being an Alaska Native is not a good thing to be? And how do we change that story? So these are going to seem a little bit disjointed, but I will tie them all in a really nice sealskin string at the end. The most dangerous question you can ask a Yupik person, especially a traditional Yupik person, is this version of question. This is what I think. This is my opinion. Am I right? You will always get the same answer. Yes. Of course you are. In the same way that people speak very lovingly to small children who really don't have a clue. And that's for a simple reason, that Yupik people really believe that Your answers to questions are really based upon your worldview, which is really based upon the experiences that you have. And when you ask us that question, we are simply validating that is your perception based upon your experience. And it's your experience, so of course your opinion is yours, and of course you are correct. And here's an example. When my nephew Jacob was 4, maybe he was 3, he asked me to hand him something, and he said, "Can you hand me that green thing right there?" And it was actually orange. And he said, "Can you hand me that green thing right there?" And I handed it to him, and I said, "Jacob, this kind of green is called orange." Very Yupik thing to say. This kind of green is called orange. And he, for the first time, experienced orange and has called it orange ever since. But that is the lens with which we draw conclusions is entirely shaped by our individual and by our collective experience. So in my conversations with Joe, I think he's amazing. But that's, I believe that because of all of the many experiences that we have had working together when I was in tribal health and also now that I'm at the state. And the conclusions that I draw about him are really based upon every experience, every interaction I have had with him, as well as what other people have said about him. But mostly it's about me. And as we do this work, we really should be thinking about the populations that we serve and are. And when we are in meetings, and I certainly asked this at the state, and it was quite shocking when I asked it, apparently, what are we doing to make sure that our workforce and our meetings really reflect the populations that we serve? So look around. Are the populations that we are studying, analyzing, researching, are they represented here? When we are having meetings, are they represented there? Or does everybody have the same haircut? And if everybody has the same haircut, we may be doing something not as inclusive as we would like to be or we intend to be. And it's important that we be as inclusive as possible. And when we do our research and we collect our data, are we asking them to validate our own opinions, which, if you're like me, we hold in very high regard? Or are we really asking them to let us know what they think? And what are the questions that they want answered? And how many things are we simply calling green because that's all we've ever known, and that's all we've ever experienced? And as we do our collective work, I would really encourage us all to really seek out other perspectives and ask, what's the real question we are asking, and what are we using it for? What are we using that information for? What's the moral of this story? How does this story end? And can we use this information to change a bad ending to a good one if we just use it differently? And as an Alaska Native, I have to tell you that I think there is a fine line between, as I hear all of those terrible statistics about who we are as people in terms of health status, et cetera, I wonder about the effect it has on my children. And there is a fine line between educating and changing behavior and self-fulfilling prophecy. And we have to be really, really careful as we share that information and remember that it doesn't have to be this way. This is where we are today. How are we going to change it so that we don't have this in the future? And there are some really, really great really great examples. So One of my favorite studies ever, it's called something entirely different, but here's how I think of it. It was a study that was done in the Bethel area with CDC, I think, and ANTHC, and it was, why do you pick, basically, it had a very scientific name, but here's how I remember it. Why do you pick women who are chubby not experience high rates of heart disease and diabetes? And the answer was simple. We eat a lot of fish and we eat seal and a traditional diet. And so the moral of that story is continue to eat a traditional diet. It's good for you. It's better than all of the processed food that you were eating. And one that I, along with my other fellow chubby Yupik women, really appreciated and really personalized in ways that was really helpful for us. And I really want to see the day that when our children hear about themselves in the news, that that it's the good things that are happening and that they know who they are. And it's those protective factors that will really help us. And remind everybody how challenging it is to not, I mean, having the information is helpful, but what do we do with the information? What's the so what? And how challenging it is to be able to change behavior. Here's another example. I was recently at a meeting with a whole bunch of sanitation engineers, and we were talking about a study that had been done, some research that had been done by a partnership with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the CDC Arctic Investigations Unit. And it was about the health impact on children in communities without adequate sanitation facilities. And as a child who grew up using a honey bucket, which had nothing to do with honey, I was very interested in this information. In Alaska, we have more than 3,000 homes without running water. Today, in this country, we have homes, especially in our region, my region, who don't have running water. And imagine the challenges of providing health care in a community without adequate sanitation. In my family, my grandmother had 9 children. 4 of them lived. And it was all, and the 4 who lived were all, I was told recently that I might be a compulsive hand washer. Because when I'm cooking, I'm washing my hands constantly. And if I'm somewhere and I'm in a restaurant, before I eat or after I'm served my food, I get up and I wash my hands. But really, in our family, hand washing is what saved those 4 kids. It's what made the difference. And so in our family, being good public health people, we are all very, I wouldn't call it, I would not have said compulsive. I would have said we are very hand washing conscious, which I think is a good thing. So the study that was done found that infants in communities without adequate sanitation facilities are 11 times more likely to be hospitalized for respiratory infections and 5 times more likely to be hospitalized for skin infections. Interesting statistic. But let's dig a little bit deeper. What that means is these are not just babies that are getting sick. These are babies that are sick enough that they have to be medevaced from their community to the regional hospital. And in terms of people, what that means is 1 out of every 3 babies in a community without adequate sanitation is medevaced every year. 1 out of 3. So look around you. 1 out of 3 of you, if you were babies, well, this would be a lot of villages, the truth. But 1 out of 3 of you, if you were babies, would have to be medevaced. And that's a pretty, pretty daunting experience. And I know a little girl who was a baby, 8 months old, who had RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. I think that's how you say it. RSV is what we call it. And she was in the hospital in Bethel for 10 days, oxygen in the nose, and then the crib. She was in an oxygen tent and the crib. But the other part of that story is she was hospitalized she has a compromised respiratory system. At one time was on 5 different medications. There's a correlation apparently also between early RSV and asthma in children. But literally for the next 7 years of her life was hospitalized every single year for pneumonia, every single year. And what are the traumatizing effects of that on this child? And yes, she was one of the 1 in 11 times more likely to be hospitalized for respiratory infections, but that's only part of the story. For the rest of her life, she will have a compromised respiratory system, and things will have to change, lifestyle, etc., really change because of that one experience. And in our communities, there are lots of children who experience that. And I know so much about that little girl because that was my daughter. And she is much healthier now. She's going to be 13 tomorrow. And so far, she still likes me. I know that could change at any moment. But I was at a meeting in which this research was being shared, and we were talking about sanitation facilities. And I was in a room. I was one of 2 non-engineers in a room full of sanitation engineers speaking about sanitation facilities from many different countries. And we were talking about not only the statistics, but also the having the water, hand washing, etc. And, you know, when you don't have a lot of water, I mean, if we were in my home village, in my brother's home village, we would all share the same bowl of water to wash our hands. And it's the woman of the house who determines when that bowl of water gets changed to fresh water. So you might be the 15th person to wash your hands in that water. And it's not cold anymore. It's very soapy, but it's not cold. As soon as they said, lunch is served, everybody got up, went to the buffet line. I and one other person were the only ones who washed our hands before we ate. And the whole meeting was all about the importance of hand washing and the importance of adequate sanitation. And none of them washed their hands. None of them. And so it was a good lesson in the importance of lessons and the importance of applying what you've learned and the importance of, making sure that we actually practice what we preach. And so, probably not at all what Joe thought I would speak about, but that's okay. So I guess in closing, I just wanted to say, Guyana Jeknak, thank you so much for all of the work that you do in your communities, for daring to ask the right question. Once you find the answers to those questions, challenging yourself to really ask, what's the point? Do people have this information? How is it useful? How are we reinforcing the importance of that message? And how are we changing behavior in ways that actually have all of that research matter? What's the point? Because if we have all of the research in the world, it's wonderful. But what do we do with that information? And I always start with the moral of the story. When you're sharing your research, what's the moral of the story? Because I have been in so many meetings where I had an hour, and for 55 minutes, the person talked about the quality of their research protocols and why these were the right markers and this was the right data set. And finally, in the last 5 minutes, said the moral of the story. I believe that your research protocols are the right one because that's what you do. I take that as a given. What I really need to know is what's the moral of the story? What does the data show? How can we use that in communities? How can we communicate that to people who won't understand the statistics? And how do we change the behavior? And yes, it's hard. It's challenging. But again, people do the most amazing things. under the most impossible conditions for the right reasons. And children are always the right reasons. Huyana.